Hello and welcome to Country Stride, the podcast dedicated to the landscapes, people and heritage of Cumbria and the Lake District. I'm here today on a beautiful spring morning. I'm in the Westmoreland Dales village of Orton, and under blue skies, I'm in the company of author, illustrator and our guide for today's walk, Mark Richards. Hello, Mark.
Hello, David. This is it. It's a wonderful corner of Cumbria that is Westmoreland, that is part of Yorkshire Dales. In effect, it is a holistic landscape all of its own.
Put us on the map, Mark, for those listeners who may not have explored this absolutely beautiful but very little visited corner of the county. Where are we?
Well, this is the village of Orton, which is, for many people who go up and down the motorway, well, perhaps a light coming south at the southbound services, Westmoreland services, and we're sort of parallel to there, just short of Tea Bay. So we're east of that setting.
We're in a lovely spot in the midst of the village here. We've got Celandine out. We're just looked down upon by the wonderful whitewashed church spire. I think a lot of people might know Orton for its chocolate factory. Very few in this county. Maybe we will go there if we have a chance later on, Mark. But today we've got a lovely podcast lined up. We haven't been for a good walk in the country for a while, so we've got that to look forward to. We've got two guests with us today with two very different areas of interest. But we're going to kind of introduce people to the area, aren't we, Mark? And one of the key themes is going to be rock, and very specifically, limestone.
Mountain limestone, as it's often called, or carboniferous limestone. This limestone is probably the oldest limestone in the Yorkshire Dales as such. So it's a really interesting one, and you've got the pavements with its grikes and clints and all that above the village. But it portrays a really ancient landscape that is a seabed. We see this now as a very open upland landscape, but there's lots of stories in there to discover, and I'm hoping that our guests will give our listeners a real feel for the importance of that geology and the botany that it harbours.
Very good. And who are those guests?
Well, we are very fortunate to have Sylvia Woodhead here with us, who has a great love for geology, and this is something that's very close to her heart, this particular landscape. And with her, of course, is her husband, Peter, who is very much involved with botany, a lifetime in education and a passion for it, and he's involved with the Cumbria Wildlife Trust.
Fabulous. Well, I think, look, we've got a 5-mile walk to get through. We know that the weather's going to be stable for at least the next few hours, so let's stride out of Orton into the great Westmoreland Dales landscape and explore the geology and the botany of this fabulous area.
Sound of the rooks in the background, a little bit of traffic going by through the village of Orton. The sun, wow, we are fortunate. Late morning, chill in the air, of course, but we're still in March. We're right in the midst of a lovely village, grey stone of the limestone in the field walls, in the cottage walls. I'm in the company of Peter and Sylvia Woodhead, and it's a wonderful occasion to share your knowledge and experience and love of this place. Peter, what's your background?
Yes, I studied in my degree work botany. I did some research for a while in marine botany, and thought that was where my future lay. But in fact, like marine creatures, I've crawled onto the land and have now become perhaps a terrestrial ecology specialist, and have worked with Cumbria Wildlife Trust for the last dozen years, and particularly interested in limestone flora. And we're in a wonderful limestone area today, so I'm looking forward to seeing the leaves of plants. There won't be many flowers yet, but it's still worth being here.
Sylvia, great to see you. And what's your passion and your interest in this setting?
My passion is the geology of this area. I'm the geological coordinator for Cumbria Geoconservation. That's a special interest group of Cumbria Wildlife Trust. And we designate a lot of local geological sites. And unlike other conservation organisations, we have a real remit for education. I've had a lifetime of education, and I can't stop telling people about how wonderful I think the landscape and the geology underlying it is. For the last 8 years, we've been involved in the Westmorland Dales, the Landscape Partnership Project, which has been a national lottery heritage funded project. And Cumbria Geoconservation led the geology project, which was called Revealing the Foundations.
Now, the Westmorland Dales, this is a quite distinct designation of the Yorkshire Dales National Park. Sylvia, can you define it for us?
Yes, it used to be an area called the Orton Fells, and for one reason or another, when Hobhouse back in the 1940s was writing his list of areas that had national park potential, this was an area that was included, but it never became a national park. But in 2016, the Yorkshire Dales National Park was extended into this area, and the area extends, as you were saying, it's east of the M6, from Tea Bay across to Kirby Stephen, and then it's taking the old boundary of the old Westmorland county, and the southern boundary is the northern edge of the Howgill Fells. But that was just the Heritage Lottery funded project. There's a lot of geology outside that area.
Can you describe some of the distinctive landscape qualities of this area?
The area is possibly not very well known, and that's one of its attractions in a way. It is peaceful, it's beautiful, there are wide open skies, there are rocks to be seen everywhere, and if you gave me my time, I would extol the virtues of the stone walls around. They're always worth a close look.
Underlying it all is the geology, and as a botanist, I'm interested in what's growing on those rocks, so you can't have one without the other. And one thing leads to another. The two are complementary, and that's what I hope we will discover today in this walk.
Now, Sylvia, you've got in your hands the special leaflet that's been prepared, which defines the route we're following. Can you quickly explain it to us?
Today we are going to walk the Orton Scar Geo Walk, which is one of four leaflets that were produced as a result of this Westmorland Dales project. Nice. We are going to go from Orton Village north, and we're going to go up to the top of Orton Scar, and we're going to go then east to the Beacon, where I hope we might stop and have a little bit of lunch. We will see some limestone pavement up there, and then we're going to follow a bridle path down past some limestone quarries, where we will see some stupendous fossils. We're going to go past a stone circle of very special boulders, and then back west towards Orton Village. As you said, I think it's a walk of, well, it says 5 miles.
There we are. We'll enjoy every stride.
I'm sure we shall.
Well, we'll make those first strides now. I love wandering through villages, and this is an exceptional one. We've come along a lane by Chapel Beck. In fact, we passed Alton Methodist Chapel, which has a lovely little meadow beside it as well. And we've come over a little bridge, and we're beside the actual beck itself. It's on our right, and we can see there's little cascades in it here. And Sylvia, this gives me the golden opportunity to ask you about the big geological feature and setting here of this great landscape.
Well, what we're looking at here is Carboniferous limestone. So you actually have to go back 350 million years.
That's when a long time ago. Where would this landscape have been at that time?
That is a very good question, because it would have been in tropical latitudes, and there would have been a warm, clear, shallow sea. It was always said it was like the Bahamas, but we think now it was perhaps a relatively narrow sea, like the Red Sea, and there were patches of coral growing in this sea. But down at the South Pole, there were glaciations. There was ice building up and the sea level went down. So the sea level went out and the corals all died. And then the sea level rose as the ice melted and you got another layer. So in this stream, you can see different layers. And we're going to be on our walk, walking over limestone layers that are, in geological terms, younger and younger, and each one is different, and each one gives a different character. So we're going to be looking for benches in the landscape. Now, although the sea was warm and clear and shallow, there were occasionally rivers, and the rivers brought in some red sand. It killed all the animals in the sea, and that formed a very special sandstone called Ashbel sandstone. And we're going to be looking for that on our walk. It is what geologists call an exposure, but it's not an outcrop. We won't see the rock. We've got to look for evidence that it was there. So geology is like a gigantic puzzle, three-dimensional or four-dimensional, looking for evidence.
You mentioned that this limestone that we're witnessing here was down by the equator, but it's no longer there.
That's exactly right, because with a process called continental drift, part of plate tectonics has moved all the Earth's crusts, and we are moving at the moment northwards, so we're about 50 to 60 degrees north, and much colder. The continents will continue to move through plate tectonic movements. We're moving sort of north and easterly, and the continents will in the future, many, many millions of years in the future, gather, I think, around what is currently the North Pole.
Somebody once told me the tectonic movement is equivalent to the speed at which your nails grow.
Absolutely, that is correct. If we had time, we'd talk about the volcanic eruptions that are occurring in Iceland, where the splitting of the plates is actually occurring, and some of that has been at a much more rapid phase. But we'd better return to limestone.
Well, that's fascinating, Sylvia. I'm tempted to get a bit further up this track. Let's go. Coming up still beside Chapel Beck, skirting through into the field, and it's got a lovely trees growing from the edge. There's a bit of a laid hedge here, but nature is abundant in this setting, and in fact I've just seen ahead of us a hare, a March hare, but it's going gently away from us. Sylvia, you've just seen some interesting plants even.
I've just seen some tiny white flowers of a wild strawberry. Peter, it would be a barren strawberry at this time of year, wouldn't it?
Yes, that's right. That's a very early flowerer. It's a potentilla, and that's a mark of spring when the spring flowers are coming out. And lots of celandine still here. And we're getting a spring bird song. The robins are singing forth. I had the goldfinches up in the trees there. There's a lot of chattering going on, and they're thinking about nest building.
While we're standing here, it's amazing what you see when you just stand and look. I know a lot of people walk really fast and they want to get there. They want to get to where they're going and get the walk over as soon as possible. But we have a smooth green hill opposite. Do you notice that it is an elongated hill covered in grass? Now, geographers would call that a drumlin. That has been deposited by the ice in this area, and we'll be seeing more evidence of what the ice did here. But that is quite a good example.
So that's deep soil in effect.
Well, we would call it till or glacial debris. It's more than soil because the glaciers covered this area. They brought boulders, which we're going to see in a moment, and they laid down something called till. Used to call it boulder clay because it was boulders with clay in it, and that obscures the rock to some extent.
And there's a hare again. It's in that meadow of yours. Oh, isn't that gorgeous? It's racing away from us. It knew we were about.
I think it was watching us and it didn't seem to be alarmed because we're standing still, just listening and looking.
As the beck opens up a little, we have a great expanse of pasture and dry stone wall to our right, and the beck comes through the gap in their wall, and there's some erratics, I noticed, actually in the bed of the stream. But I'm intrigued by the pasture. It's got lots of mowdywarps on it, molehills. Is there anything distinctive about that pasture?
At the moment, it looks very undistinguished, doesn't it? A thatch of dead grassland and some rushes and so on. But come at a later time of the year, and this is alive with wildflowers. The meadows here and beyond the stone wall that we can see going up the hillside are sites of special scientific interest, or SSSI. That is, designated sites for northern hay meadows. And these are now vanishing and have been for the last 50 years. The flowers, orchids everywhere alongside the path here when we come, say, in June or July. And some of the flowers associated with the bank sides of the beck are really very special. We've had celandines lower down in the village, and here there's a bank of colt's foot, just newly out in flower. The flowers are there, obviously, as reproduction organs, and there are insects already settling on them, feeding on the pollen at this early stage in the year. And the insects, of course, will be transferring pollen from one flower to the next, so doing their job as pollinators. Lovely to see at this time of year.
Well, ahead of us, we can see a farmstead, the prow of the hill, Orton Scar, rising up there with the distinctive field walls that climb the hill and go lateral across the slope. Our eyes are drawn up to a lane leading towards a farmstead. We've come up above the farmstead, up a pasture, with the elements of the beck open in the pasture. We've come through a gate which actually shows the coast-to-coast signpost on it. So the path ahead of us, the coast-to-coast, the path that veers to the right is the path going east towards Kirby Stephen. It's naturally drawn us over to a wall which is covered in moss, sign of a very damp environment, obviously. From behind the wall, there is a trough and a resurgence where the stream, the headstream of Chapel Beck, emerges from the bedrock. Limestone and water have a curious relationship. Water comes and goes, doesn't it, Sylvia?
Well, it does. It's one of the big queries about limestone country. From now on, we'll be on dry rock, and any water that falls will dominantly be disappearing down the joints, and water will widen those joints. Now, it goes underground. It goes down the joints and then along the bedding planes. And here, apparently, there is an outcrop of the Ashfell sandstone. Very unusual sandstone. It's made of sand grains, cemented together with sand, and water can't get into it. So when the water reaches the sandstone, which we can't actually see, it comes out onto the surface and runs down to Orton as the Chapel Beck that we've been following.
Another ology is speleology, that is potholing. Is that something you've ever engaged in?
Well, if you must mention it, the answer is yes. Certainly, I have a recollection of being in a cave in Dentdale. It was a bedding plane cave, so it's flat and low, and I'm flat out. And it's dry and sandy, and there's limestone below, and there's limestone above. I loved caving because you're up and close to the rocks, and you're in the layers. But this particular time, you could hear water. And in the limestone layer above where we were was the plunge pool of a waterfall. And I was lying in this bedding plane, dry and safe, saying, limestone's impermeable, limestone's impermeable. I'm perfectly safe here, because the layer of limestone must have been so massive that the water couldn't actually get into it. And if we can find some limestone and I pour some water on, I can demonstrate that the water cannot get into the mass of limestone. It has to disappear down the joints. So yes, I recommend caving to people as getting inside the rock. It's what all geologists really ought to be doing.
Well, we've come up the funneling of the wall, which has brought us up onto the escarpment, drawing us up the pasture. I can see a guy on his quad bike shepherding his sheep. It's a lovely, spacious view looking south. In front of me is a lime kiln, and it's about 5.5 feet to the arch. It's quite a modest one. It's in a limestone outcropping. Sylvia, perhaps you could explain the background to what it was there for and how it would be operated.
Yes, this is a wonderful example of a lime kiln. It's absolutely typical because it's built into, as you say, the little escarpment. And the cliffs on either side were actually quarries. And the limestone would have been removed and taken into the top of the lime kiln. Now, the limestone would have needed to have been melted, and they used coal amazingly. Now, if you say to local people, but there's no coal here, they'll say, look at the Ordnance Survey map, the north sheet of the Orton map, and there's coal marked in various place names. It was within the rocks that are above the Carboniferous limestone, the Yoredale formation. The coals would have been very thin. They might not have been very good. And we know from Keith Cooper, who lives in Asby, that he's done some research, and these lime kilns were used by travelling groups of people who only fired them once every few years, and they would fire for perhaps a few weeks. The limestone would burn to produce slaked lime.
You might ask, well, what was that used for? What's the point on this bare hillside of producing lime? Well, firstly, the soil here sits on top of limestone outcrops, but just further down, with the action of rainwater and so on, the soil gets progressively more acid, and the farmer would very much want to restore some base-rich minerals into the soil. So some of it is going as soil top dressing. Some of the lime would be used for mortar, making mortar to build farmhouses, and some for the grander farmhouses as part of lime wash, because there are various uses for it. It seems very much out of the way here, but it's an integral aspect of the industrial side of the countryside.
Indeed. Orton Church is whitewashed.
It is. That whitewash, the lime wash, was replaced very recently, and we asked the people who were doing it, and they said, yes, we're using all the old methods. That is what has been required, and it's horrid stuff.
It burns a hand.
It does, yes.
Well, we'll wander around to the top and have a look where the coal and the limestone enters the actual lime kiln. We're at the top now, and the great hole at the top has been filled in. How did it operate, Sylvia?
The lime and the coal were both loaded into the top of the lime kiln, and it's rather windy today, so I think the aim was to get a really good draft, to get a good burn.
Just round the edge of the hole at the top of the lime kiln, I can see some blocks of sandstone, which are obviously local sandstone, this ash fell sandstone, which show the evidence that they have been fired at some point. Now, they would have formed the lining of the pot, which forms the upper part of the lime kiln. And that would have narrowed to a narrow base with a grid at the bottom to stop everything falling out immediately. But once you've got molten lime after it's burning, that would have drained through into a chamber below, which could then be filled up and the lime pulled out from the bottom.
Well, the wind is coming from the west and ushering us up onto the high ground. We come along beside a gorgeous wall, which draws us naturally onto the hilltop. And the pasture is, as one would expect on limestone, very open and clean. But suddenly, I've come upon a swathe of heather, just short of a little escarpment bank of limestone. So, goodness only knows, Peter, what's that heather doing there?
Yeah, well noticed that, Mark, because heather is a plant, as we know, from acid soils. If you want to grow it at home in your garden, it's acid compost that you use. It's not normally found on limestone, and yet here it is in limestone scenery. What it suggests to me is that it's actually not growing on the limestone, but there's a belt here of some depth of glacial material, which is probably acid in nature, the acid that the heather loves, and that's where it's got a foothold and is able to thrive. To one side of it, it's limestone grassland with characteristic limestone plants. To the other side, the limestone scarp, it's not going to grow there, and it's restricted. So these plants are quite good chemists, you know.
They are indeed. Sylvia, I noticed there's a series of little hollows in that heather. What does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that underneath the heather and underneath the glacial drift, there is limestone, and the rain that fortunately is not falling today would go down through joints in the limestone, widen them, and some of the glacial material would go into those holes. So we've got a whole series of holes that are called shake holes locally, or sink holes. We don't call them swallow holes because nothing's being swallowed up because we haven't in fact encountered any water since we came up here.
This wall next to us, I think, is rather intriguing. It defines something, does it?
Dave was saying that he thought the wall was pretty untidy, but it's very ancient. It's one of the oldest walls in the area. It's a major parish boundary. It marks the boundary of the huge Orton parish to one side, and we're now in the Crosby Ravensworth parish. So it's a parish wall. Now, we're going up all these layers in the limestone, successively younger layers, because the ones on top are younger than the ones below. And David Evans, the scheme manager of the Landscape Partnership, likened this to layers of lasagna. And I thought, that's a wonderful analogy, and it does remind me, we could have a spot of lunch up at the top.
Well, we've made it onto the top of Beacon Hill, which is limestone. I think there's quite a bit of limestone being taken from this space. But the wind, I think it must always be blowy here. And a good place for a bonfire. Well, ha! Coincidentally, there's this lovely monument here, which actually records evidence of a particular bonfire. On the 21st of June, 1887, this ancient beacon fire was kindled by the loyal subjects of Crosby, Ravensworth and Orton to commemorate the Jubilee year of the beneficent reign of Her Gracious Majesty Victoria, Queen and Empress. Wow, there you are. Well, it's an Empress view here. I'll look to the north and I can see Blencathra. So that's a very comforting benchmark for the view. And that leads round to the High Street Range. And I can't see particular summits very well. I was hoping I'd see Ill Bell, but I can't really pick it out. But you certainly can see the Westmorland and Borrowdale fells of Windfell, Beacon, through to Jeffrey's Mount and Loon Gorge with the Great Rig Forest. And then the ridge that leads up towards Fell Head and the Calf. What's that one up there? It's up Langdale, isn't it? So it's Hazelgill Knot and Randigill Knot, Greenbell, which of course is the source of the River Loon, which runs away through Orton, down through Tea Bay and so forth. And you can see just to the left of Greenbell, Swarthfell and the long plateau top of Wild Boar Fell. Beyond that, going round southeastward from here, Malastang Edge, High Seat, the head of Birkdale, Nine Standards Rig. People have heard of that one on the coast to coast, of course. And it leads round above Stainmore. There's some lovely limestone over there above Brough. The Walkup Firing Ranges, Roman Fell and Mickle Fell, and High Cup Valley, and round by Knock Fell, Great Dun Fell with its golf ball, Little Dun Fell, and Cross Fell, which is the highest point on the Pennine Range, up towards Geltsdale where I live, and Cardunnoth Pike. The view sort of peters out there because we're back round to Blencathra. And it's a magnificent view and very breezy. And we're actually looking down the Livniet Valley here, which runs down towards Crosby Ravensworth, of course. This is a magnificent view, and it's a view that you dearly love, Sylvia. What is it about it?
That is so difficult to say because there is just so much to see, as you've just described, in every direction. Wonderful vistas of hills. I mean, if we look into the Howgills to the south, the ones that Wainwright called the sleeping elephants, they're the older Silurian rocks. They were formed in a deep, muddy sea, so they're poor slate, and they form these steep but smooth slopes, very distinctive, with the valleys that you mentioned coming down.
How old is the rock there, the Silurian?
You would ask that, wouldn't you? Around 400 and something million years. But
certainly older than this limestone.
Certainly older than the limestone, yeah. That's the oldest rock of the area. But I do love the way that the limestone is bare for you to see. It is just a mind-blowing, wonderful vista. And the cobwebs get thoroughly blown away in this wind.
Sylvia loves the view. Is that the same for you, Peter?
Yes. I'm fascinated being on the top of this particular outcrop. We can see to the south the River Loon and its catchment. The River Loon, it turns a right angle and flows south and goes into Morecambe Bay. If we swing round to the east, we see the Eden, and the Eden catchment is flowing north. So we are virtually on the watershed between these two, and you look round and there's no water to be seen. Well, where is it? Because it's been pretty damp recently. Of course, it's down in the ground, in the limestone, deep beneath our feet. And it's amazing to me that some of it will go north to the Eden and out into the Solway, and just a few metres perhaps the other way, and it will flow south into the Loon and into Morecambe Bay.
And the Eden is the only English river that flows north its entire course.
I didn't know that fact before now. Thank you, Mark.
We've come onto some very distinctive rocky area. This limestone pavement. It's lovely to encounter something as raw and as hard as this. Sylvia, can you give me the explanation of what we're actually looking at?
Well, the limestone here was formed as a sort of limey mud in these tropical seas. And as it turned from loose sediment into a rock, it contracted and formed joints. And these joints have been widened by rainwater into moderately deep grikes, which are cutting vertically down into the rock. And you're standing on a block of limestone, yep, which we would call a clint.
Right.
And you have got a grike to one side of you and a grike to the other side
this
of you.
This one goes eastward. It's right. Clint eastward.
Right. Thank you for that, Mark. Everyone believes it was formed in the Ice Age, that the glaciers, the ice over here, eroded away what was left on top, exposing the limestone pavement. Some people think that the limestone pavement actually formed when the limestone was forming 350 million years ago. Uh-huh. As it was on that tropical beach, it dried out. But there were rainstorms which led to its formation. So it may be an exhumed landscape, a landscape that formed a long time ago. Now, some of the evidence for that is some of these rounded solution grooves that we can see on some of the surfaces. They're called runnels.
So what is a solution, Sylvia?
Oh, right. Well, yes, the rainwater that falls dissolves away some of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, forming a dilute carbonic acid, and it falls onto the limestone and dissolves it immediately. And so what happens is a raindrop falls. Now, can you see that it's sort of pitted, this surface? Each one of those possibly represents a raindrop falling. The instant it falls on the limestone, it dissolves the limestone away, and that water then disappears down the widened joints. It is thought that the greatest solution occurs the instant the acidulated rainwater hits the limestone. And the other interesting feature is that this reaction is greater in colder temperatures than it is in warmer temperatures.
Intriguing, Peter, moving away from the actual rock itself. In the grikes, the cracks, there are plants growing, and I can see a fern down in one. It cultivates its own botany.
Yes. If you're looking at the top surface, there's very little growing on the limestone itself. It's too exposed for it, and it gets very dry because, as Sylvia has pointed out, the rain disappears very quickly. The only place that plants really are able to survive is in shelter, where there's a supply of water, and ideally at least some minerals in solution. And this place for them is in these grikes, or in little hollows which are out of the top surface. And what we can see down in these grikes is a hart's tongue fern, which you notice very carefully there.
Yep.
It's a very popular fern in people's gardens because it grows very nicely indeed on limestone. There's some herb robert I've seen, and there are clumps of the blue moorgrass, which is very much a speciality of limestone, in the sheltered areas, and lots of mosses. Again, they're in the shelter, and there's plenty of moisture.
As the year unfolds and the summer expands the life cycle of the plants, you get some lovely flowers.
Yes, we call it a micro habitat. In other words, it's on a small scale, much smaller than the big landscape that we've been looking at, and this microhabitat has sometimes a very different climate indeed. The temperature will stay cool in summer, it will stay sheltered and warmer in winter, and it also maintains the moisture so that plants are able to survive even under drought conditions. And that, of course, is absolutely critical. So these are in microclimates, in microhabitats.
Have you a particular favourite of this sort of landscape?
Well, the mosses and some of the ferns are some of the things I like best in these limestone grikes. There is one really rare fern, I don't think we'll find it today, called the holly fern, simply because the fronds are quite prickly, and so it describes the way holly leaves are. But certainly it does grow in the Westmorland Dales in exactly this habitat. And the hartstongue, very pretty too. Some of the limestone ones like walrue and maidenhair spleenwort, these are lovely limestone specialities.
Lovely names in themselves.
Yes.
When we just come round a corner, we've got a linear quarry face, I would say, ins and outs and ins and outs on knot or cannot. It's a limestone exposure. It's got a multiplicity of layers or bands. To the untrained eye, it's just rock. But to the trained eye, and my trained eye is beside me, Sylvia, give us a little bit of a clue as to what we might be looking at here.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're exactly right. What we're looking at is layers of limestone. We would call them beds, and each one has been deposited at a different time. And so the one at the bottom is the oldest, and the one at the top is the youngest. And before you ask, we've no idea how long these took to be deposited. It could be millions of years, or it could be one storm. But they have between them layers which are called bedding planes. Now, the thing that really excites me about all these different layers of limestone is that the grey limestone is absolutely full of past life. There are fossils galore to satisfy everybody here. I think I can tell you about them because I don't think they can be damaged, but you can look at them and photograph them and try to identify them and wonder at them.
Now, you've told us there's a multiplicity of life in this cliff face. Could you talk us through it a little?
Well, certainly, yes. I think on this layer here, which is the top of the lowest bed, there are a whole series of shells, and we would call these brachiopods. The animal lived inside a shell with another shell on top and collected its food.
Filter feeding.
So we see those as sort of semicircular marks. Now, further up the quarry, we have got some corals.
It looks like a wonderful bit of sculpture ornamentation. It's marvellous.
It is marvellous. What we've got is a little outcrop of the grey limestone. And most of it is grey and smooth, and it's made of lime mud, broken bits of a coral reef. But what you've described is an actual fossil coral colony.
Crikey.
What you can see is a rounded base, and then you have all these tubes going up. And if you look across at the top of them, that's where the little coral animal lived. Everyone's seen coral reefs on the television. And they would have tentacles that they would wave in the sea water, and the seawater would bring them food. And each year, they built themselves a limy structure. So these are their outside skeletons. You can tell from these how long the day length was in the past. And this particular one, geologists would call in situ. It's in its life position.
Wow.
That is how it grew.
Amazing.
350-odd million years ago. Now, it is a fossil. It's dead. And it is, in fact, an extinct kind of fossil. The corals we see in the current seas are called hexacorals. They are not actually the same as these. These all became extinct in one of the many great extinctions.
Wow, absolutely staggering.
Peter's pointing out that they occur in a particular band. Now, unfortunately, we're probably looking at an extinction event. Because it's very sad, they all died.
Yes.
My eye has just got caught to a layer above where I can see some lovely marks, and a layer even further above, there's a spiral, which is a gastropod, life that would have swum in the coral sea.
You mentioned this earlier, this area of like a graveyard. Were there sort of events that would cause a mass death?
I think there must have been, because the limestone that we're looking at has massive limestone with not very many fossils, and then the fossils, as we've been following them, are limited to a particular horizon. So something must have happened then. What that something is, we're not absolutely sure. Now, some people think it might have been a volcanic eruption and that volcanic ash was deposited here. There's not much evidence in the Lake District for that, but in the Peak District there is. But it could just have been that the sea level went down and they were exposed to desiccation, so they died that way. Or it could have been that a river brought in some mud and swamped them all, and they died that way, suffocated them. Yeah. But the sad thing is they are dead.
I asked Peter earlier on, Sylvia, what was his favourite plant? Which is your favourite fossil?
Well, it's really difficult, isn't it? But as I'm looking at some coral, I'll say that coral, because of what it means in terms of the coral reefs that we see on the television, and here they are literally fossilised in this limestone cliff.
Well, that's fascinating. I think what we ought to do now is go down to Gamylands to see the stone circle. Well, we've made our way down to Gamylands Stone Circle, which is below the knot, and there's about 30 stones, would you say? It's about 50 metres across, pretty near to a full regular circle, but not quite. But it's composed of the interesting feature of Shap granite erratics, not native stone to this place. So it was carried here, Sylvia.
It was indeed, and it came from Shap Quarry, which we would be able to see apart from the impending storm. Now, this granite is completely unique. There is apparently no granite anywhere else in the world that has these huge pink crystals of feldspar in it.
Oh.
There are lots of different kinds of granite, but this particular one probably had a two-stage cooling. It formed deep in some mountains, Devonian times, and it formed these very large rectangular pink crystals. And then it cooled deep underground, and that's when the other crystals formed inside it. Now, it only occurs at Shap, where it's quarried. It has made beautiful ornamental stone. Now, the question is, how comes it to be here? Because the quarry is some miles over there, and the idea is that it's all been transported by ice, which is why we call it an erratic. And in the past, people have moved the stones into this near circle because the stones must have meant something to them.
Location here is significant with the actual movement of ice in the depth of the Ice Age.
That's right, yes. It's sort of an ice shed area where ice from Scotland coming down the Irish Sea met with ice coming from the Lake District and ice coming from the Pennines, and those ice masses sort of interfered with each other and pushed backwards and forwards. Now, these erratics have been traced from Shap Quarry right the way across to the east coast, right the way down through the Teabay Gorge to Kendal, and so they give us quite a lot of information about the way that some of the ice moved at some of the times during the very early ice ages.
And what depth of ice are we talking at its highest?
It's not really possible to say because it's gone, but possibly a kilometre, do we think?
1 to 2 kilometres. So that's about a mile high. The ice was going in both directions simultaneously?
There's a lot of research that's taking place at the moment in various universities looking at how ice moves. And I think we are concluding that the ice moves in a lot of different ways. Last week I was hearing that ice can actually move over 100 metres in a day by distortion and sliding on meltwater. And there is some evidence that ice can be so thick that different parts of it can flow in different directions. Before we leave this area, I'd just like to say that at the end of the Westmorland Dales project, some interpretation boards were put in. These are new. There is one on the lane outside, and there's one on the car park that was formed as a result of the project. The car park enables people to park and visit this area without damaging the wonderful verges, which will be full of wildflowers later on in the year.
Well, that's been fantastic. A great finale to come to these stone circles. I always love stone circles, like Long Meg, but the westerly winds are carrying quite a body of rain. After all the wonderful weather we've had today, I think we better batten down the hatches of our cags and head back to Alton. We've had a lovely little wander from Gammylands, largely on a minor road, which was a sheer delight to follow. We saw this enormous storm coming towards us, and it looked absolutely laden. The wind was blowing it straight to us, and somehow or other, it turned a right-hand bend, went off to the south, and we've been in sunlight most of the walk, so we're laughing, really. I'm going to turn my mind to the project that has come to an end, the Westmorland Dales project, which has born on a love of this great landscape and the need to understand it more and to appreciate its many qualities. And I'd like to ask Sylvia, you've spent an enormous amount of time getting to know this place and falling in love with it all the more. Are there two elements of it that really are dearest to your heart?
I think, like Wainwright, I would have to say that it's what I'm looking at the moment, a view of Drumlins in Orton Village. But two special places I could recommend people to go to visit are Smardale, which is an absolute gem, and Kirby Stephen and the walk to Stencrith Gorge to look at that enigmatic rock, the Brockram. And it just so happens there are two geology walk leaflets which are available on our website, so people can follow those.
Sounds wonderful. Peter, you're in the same boat. You've found a great deal to love about this place. What are the two places that you can express?
Difficult questions kept till the end. Yes, I love an area, I think, technically just outside Ravenstone Dale and therefore outside the area of Westmorland Dales, but it is the Fell End Clouds at Stenuskew, limestone country again, very similar to that we've been walking through today. Absolutely wonderful. And my second, even above Stenuskew, Sunbig in Tarn and Little Asby there. Magical place, every essence of this beautiful landscape.
Well, Sylvia, if listeners want to know more about this wonderful project and what it's produced, where do people go to learn more?
I think there are three main places. There's the website of Cumbria Geoconservation. There's the website of the Westmorland Dales, which is hosted now on the Friends of the Lake District. And on the Yorkshire Dales website, there is the Dales Rocks website. If you click on that, there is a special area of the Westmorland Dales.
Talking of rocks, you and Peter have really rocked today. It's been tremendous being out with you. I love this area, but to be with actual genuine people who know what they're talking about, you focus my attention wonderfully. I love the landscape in a wider sense, but boy, didn't you bring all the detail to life. So thank you, Sylvia and Peter.
A total pleasure.
Journey's end, and we have arrived back under blue skies again after that threatened squall earlier in Orton. What a lovely walk. I really enjoyed today, Mark.
Oh, gosh. I love being up on limestone, and in this Dales setting, the diversity of valley settings in Cumbria are remarkable, but this is one of those special ones above the Lune Valley, the upper reaches.
The view that we got there from our high point of today, I can't think of many spots in the county that you get a better view. I mean, you're looking at the Howgills, the Pennines, the Lake District Fells. It's incredible, really. What a great walk it's been, and we've been blessed with weather and two fabulous guests. I do think, incidentally, some of the fossils, again, are kind of remarkable. That first one of the old coral, it's amazing, isn't it?
Wasn't it just? I couldn't believe my eyes. I can visualise it, actually, from what I've seen on television, the marine movement of the tentacles, as it were, pointing up, and there they were.
It's there, in the rock, here in Cumbria, just like 2 minutes' walk from a little car park.
350 million years old.
Genuinely incredible, yeah. Hearty recommendation to come and do this. Okay, we come to the end of the podcast housekeeping. First of all, a correction, Mark. We've been sent a correction. This is Robert Beale, who walked with us, if you remember, down the south end of Windermere. Very enjoyable it was too.
Indeed.
Anyway, he wrote to us and said he'd made an error. He said, when talking about the glaciers, I accidentally mentioned a glacier coming from Kentmere when I meant Troutbeck. He said, it's odd, as I mention it every day in my commentary. I had a minor brain block. Please, can you correct this? Yes, we can, Robert. Thank you. Delighted to do so. And, of course, we've just been talking about glaciers. So,
there you
go. All good, yeah. If you enjoyed this podcast, the best possible way to support it is to either buy one of our many guidebooks available at www.countrystride.co.uk, or, indeed, we are on Patreon. You can gift us as little as £2 a month, which pays for the hosting, for the travel, for the editing, all of those kind of things. And as ever, thank you to all of those who support us. It means that we can carry on doing this rather lovely tribute to Cumbria, its people, its heritage and its landscapes. It's been such a great day. Loved Orton. Come and check this area out if you haven't already. And I think we'll put a little map, or at least links to the map for this walk, on the website. But we're signing off for now on an absolutely beautiful spring evening from Orton in the Westmorland Dales.